and introduce the struggle for civil rights. I can see from this one person's act that my mother was right. After listening to my mom's account of Rosa Parks' protest, I thought about the power she had, the power to challenge segregation and to stand up for what she believed was right. Rosa Parks was a true catalyst for change, and she was only one person. Hearing about Rosa Parks and her protest showed me that there is hope for me and all the students in Ms. G's classes to truly be catalysts for change. Imagine if there were 150 Rosa Parks standing up for tolerance. What a difference we would make.
Diary 75. Dear Diary, I feel like I finally have a purpose in this class and in life. That purpose is to make a difference and stand up for a cause. Ms. G showed us a video during Black History Month about a group of civil rights activists in the 1960s who were inspired by Rosa Parks. They decided to challenge segregation in the South. Rather than boycott buses, they took their challenge a step farther. They integrated their bus and traveled from Washington, D.C. through the Deep South. There were 7 whites and 6 blacks on the bus, most of them college students. They were called the Freedom Riders, and their goal was to change segregated interstate travel, along with everyone's life, forever. The Freedom Riders had faith that what they were doing was right, and they wanted the world to know that change was necessary and that being tolerant of each other is good. I can picture myself on the road with that bus. I can visualize pulling into the bus station in Montgomery, Alabama, to discover the unsettling quietness. Even though they didn't expect a warm welcome, no one was to be seen at the station, not even the attendants. All of a sudden, Ku Klux Klan members were everywhere. Hundreds of them surrounded the bus. Some carried bats or metal poles, and others held vicious German shepherds, growling and ready to attack these unarmed people. The mob was just waiting to get their hands on the riders. The Freedom Riders were barricaded on the bus. The mob, armed and hungry to attack, was just waiting for their first victim to step off that bus. By choice, the seating arrangement on the bus was integrated. Blacks sat by whites and vice versa. They were breaking a law that had been established in the South. This was unheard of. Jim Zwerg, a white man, stood up from the back of the bus. He wanted to be the first person to step off, even though he knew at the other side of the door was a mob of bigots drooling for a victim. What was he thinking? He felt this was his chance to fight back, nonviolently, and show his feelings to others. These strong feelings put his life at risk. Jim took that first step off of the bus, and the mob pulled him into their grasp. It was as if he'd been swallowed up and disappeared, like bees on honey. Jim was almost beaten to death. He suffered a cracked skull from being hit with an iron pipe, a broken leg, and many cuts and bruises. During the moments the mob was beating on him, the other Freedom Riders got a chance to run for shelter. I was impressed that Jim had made a choice to be on that bus when he didn't have to. After all, he was white and could sit wherever he wanted and risk everything when he didn't have to. He wanted to fight for others who didn't have the same privileges or rights as he did, which made me realize that's been my role for the last 2 years. Since I'm white and my parents make a lot of money, I probably could have gotten out of Ms. G's class if my parents had made a big enough fuss. I'm sure that because of Jim's choice of riding the bus with black people, a lot of his peers must have thought he was crazy. After all, he didn't have to, so why get himself into trouble? I guess in my way I've been like Jim, and I didn't even know it. By making the choice to stay in Ms. G's class since my freshman year, I forced myself to fit the cause. People gave those riders a chance to get off the bus, and they didn't. And I'm going to face intolerance head-on as well. The way I feel about segregation in school is the way Jim must have felt about segregation in the 60s. I want people to interact with different cultures and races. I don't want segregation like you see in class or in the school quad. The way Jim must have felt when he stepped off the bus is probably the same way I felt those first couple of days in the class. I remember feeling scared, like a wimp. I was the only white student in the class. I felt helpless. But after I stayed in the class and toughed it out, a lot more white students transferred in, just like more people joined the Freedom Rider movement after Jim's first step. At the end of the video, a fellow classmate asked the question, "They fought racism by riding the bus?" That was it. The bells were ringing, the sirens were sounding. It hit me. The Freedom Riders fought intolerance by riding a bus and pushing the racial limits in the Deep South. Then somebody suggested that we name ourselves the Freedom Riders in honor of the Freedom Riders. Why not? It's perfect. But those are huge shoes to fill, so if we're going to take their name, we better take their courage and conviction. It's one thing to ride a bus, but they eventually had to get off and face the music. So it's one thing for us to write diaries like Anne and Zlata. But if we want to be like the Freedom Riders, we need to take that extra step. Just like Anne's story made it out of the attic and Zlata's out of the basement, I hope our stories make it out of Room 203. Now when I write, I'll remember Jim's work and what he risked his life for. Like him, I am willing to step forward, unafraid of who or what lies ahead. After all, history tells me that I am not alone. Diary 76. Dear Diary, me cleaning my mother's blood off the wall represented the tornado breaking and destroying her face. I like to call my mother's boyfriend the tornado. After he would hit, everything would look like it had been caught in a whirlwind. Our apartment, our sanity, and my mother's face. I was cleaning up after the tornado hit my house and diminished everything, washing my mom's blood, which was shed from time to time, a sacrifice to make him happy. He lived for blood, her blood, enjoying every fist that hit her flesh and every scream that took place. While he broke televisions, stereos, VCRs, and the dining room table, it didn't compare to the breaking of her mind. My mom was never the same, and neither was I. Damn, that was really deep. I think now that we're Freedom Writers, we're taking the freedom writing part to heart. We've decided to bind all our diary entries and call it An American Diary, Victims of an Undeclared War. Someone said he refused to be called a victim, and we all agreed. So we came up with Voices instead. Since we titled it An American Diary, Voices from an Undeclared War, we felt that someone should hear our voices. But who would be the right person to listen? We wanted to shoot big. The mayor? No. The governor? Hell no. Some of us are still upset about Proposition 187. The president? Nah. We wanted somebody who had a direct effect on education. Miss G mentioned some guy named Richard Riley. Supposedly, he's the top dog in his field. I think he's the United States Secretary of Education. He claims he wants to get to know America's youth. And as part of America's youth, we would give it to him straight. He's adamant about changing education, and we're adamant about revolutionizing it. He's perfect, but there's a catch. He's in Washington. Just when we were about to leave that idea alone, someone said, "That would make it even better, because that's where the Freedom Riders started their mission." It made perfect sense, but one question: how the hell are we going to get there? Since we became the Freedom Riders, people have been acting even crazier than ever. They stay after school and even come in at lunch. Last night, we didn't leave here until 10 p.m., and the custodian had to kick us out. We tried to bribe him with pizza, but it didn't work. That's nothing compared to the other night, though, when we almost got arrested. We were editing stories, and before we knew it, it was 11 at night. Fred made all of us, even Miss G, climb out the window so the alarms wouldn't go off. Somebody must have seen us, because within 30 seconds, Miss G's car was surrounded by 5 cop cars. They thought that we were jacking our own computers. They found it hard to believe that we were studying, and it was even harder to believe that some of us hoodlums were still at school. What was worse is that they didn't believe Miss G was our teacher. Maybe it was because she looked somewhat like us. She was wearing my big-ass sweats because we had made her change out of her suit to be more comfortable. Her hair was up in a ponytail, so she looked like a teenager. They must have thought that her car was our G-ride. They were about to arrest us all, until we found Miss G's Teacher of the Year plaque in the back of her Forerunner. It's weird, but this incident brought us all closer together. How many people could say that they almost got arrested with their teacher? The fact that Miss G was willing to get arrested to help us complete a writing assignment was a sign of loyalty, and we respect her more for it. It's ironic how Miss G is helping us to write about an undeclared war, and that night she was helping us fight it. She proved to us that she was down for us. So now we had to be down for her. We have to trust her, even if it does mean doing the impossible to make our trip to Washington, D.C. possible.
Diary 77. Dear Diary, we decided to have a concert in order to raise money for our Washington, D.C. trip. There is no better satisfaction than watching our small ideas become a big show. I am so excited. The people who bought tickets to our Echoes of the Soul fundraising concert did not simply support 150 high school kids. They supported a cause. Tonight is our night to shine. We'll have Latin dances, singing of all types, Cambodian dances, a fashion show, and even skits. The diversity of ideas, traditions, and spirit is the true purpose of the Freedom Riders. It used to be that no one believed in us, but now our whole community is behind us and cheering us on.
Diary 78. Dear Diary, I read this poem at the Freedom Riders concert. An innocent freedom writer. A young black boy filled with innocence and care, looking for someone, but no one is there. His first day of school, the father's not around to comfort his son when he's sad and down. Looks up to his brother, who knows money and power, watching his back every single hour. An innocent boy is now 12 years of age and finds himself locked up in a human-sized cage. An innocent young man is now a criminal mind, having nightmares of murders every single time. But this time you'll think this fool should see the light, but he's jumped in a gang and they nickname him Snipe. Kicked out of the house and left in the cold. Have you been through this at 11 years old? He says to himself, "No one cares for me," then makes his bed in an old park tree. The next time, a park bench. How long can it last? Will he forget this dreadful, dreadful past? He goes to Wilson High with a messed up trail and meets a guardian angel named Aaron Gruel. He learns about the Holocaust, Anne Frank, and the Jews. Now the time comes that he should choose. He meets Anna, Terry, Tommy, and others. These are the innocent boy's new sisters and brothers. A 0.5, now a 2.8. Change is good for those that wait. He's back to innocence, but still has fear that death is upon him and drawing near. But people say it's hard to see this life of emotions is all about me. All this is true because I'm not a liar. Just a broken-hearted male with a label, Freedom Writer.
Diary 79. Dear Diary, I think I'm pretty lucky. I have a good life, a loving family, and a beautiful home. My friends, however, are not as fortunate as I am. Some have been in trouble with the law, have family disputes, or are just alone and have no one to turn to. I did not find out how much other teenagers go through until we started writing and editing our stories. The more I read, the more I found out about my peers' personal problems. Even though I don't have my own sad story, I am willing to help, listen, and encourage other Freedom Riders to tell their stories. People should hear what they go through and understand that no one comes from a perfect home. I believe that the passion behind our stories will speak as loud as the words in it. We have the same passion and hope as the Freedom Riders had when they traveled from city to city across the South. Freedom Riders stood out among the crowd, trying to bring an end to segregation between whites and blacks by traveling from Washington, D.C. to New Orleans. Without the collaboration of both the Caucasians and the African Americans, they would not have won the battle. They worked together as one to win the war against ignorance. Our camaraderie has more than just two sides, and I feel really fortunate to be a part of this new movement that's not just black and white. We are following in their footsteps by traveling from California to Washington, D.C., announcing to everyone that we are strong and we will be heard. Our trip to Washington is to prove the passion behind our cause. Just like the Freedom Riders, we are going to fight for what we believe in. Being able to look into another person's life is one thing, but doing something about it is another. I feel that we have the potential to help those who fear to speak for themselves. But speaking out is not always easy. We may face a lot of closed-minded people along the way. So, just like the Freedom Riders who didn't give up when their bus got bombed or when they were beat up by the Klan, I hope we'll stand strong like the Dylan Thomas poem and not go gently into that good night. We want people who are adults to take the time to listen to teenagers and respect what we have to say. So we came up with the idea that the best way to tell our side of the story is to give our diaries to Secretary of Education Richard Riley. If we could hand-deliver our stories to Secretary Riley, then one more person will know the problems teenagers face day by day. Unfortunately, a lot of adults are too blind or cold-hearted to see our pain. But blinding yourself to the realities that our teenagers go through is like seeing a murder and turning the other way. I am not going to let that happen. I will fight along with the other Freedom Riders to stand up, speak out, and rage against the dying of the light. Hopefully, when we're in Washington, Secretary Riley won't turn us away or stay blind to our cause. Diary 80. Dear Diary, I can't believe I'm here in our nation's capital. I'm so excited. I have never felt so free. But at the same time, I'm scared about my dad coming back and finding out that I'm gone. He's in Mexico, and I don't know when he's going to come back. If he was home, I wouldn't have been able to come. He's very strict and old-fashioned. I'm not allowed to do anything after school. I've had to miss every trip that involved the Freedom Riders. I didn't get to go to the Marriott to meet Zlata. I didn't get to go to the Museum of Tolerance and see Schindler's List. I didn't even get to go to medieval times. Every time my friends came home from a field trip, I felt so left out. Everyone had something to share, and I didn't. I would listen, look at their pictures, and hide my tears. Every time Ms. G tried to get me to go, I always said, no. I already knew what my dad's answer would be, no. During my sophomore year, I used to beg to go, but my dad would always say, you already know the answer, so don't ask. From that point on, I just stopped asking. It hurt too much to hear him say no. When the Washington trip first came up, I just assumed I wasn't going. The thought of getting away ran through my mind many, many times. I never realized that my wish would actually come true. Every time Ms. G asked for a final headcount to reserve our plane tickets, I never responded. Deep down inside, it was killing me. I'd never been on a plane before, never stayed in a hotel or left my house, for that matter. I'm like a prisoner in my own home. I'm not even allowed to talk on the phone. If I do, my dad disconnects it. If anybody calls me, he tells him or her, she doesn't live here, and hangs up. Then I get screamed at. 3 days before the trip, a miracle happened. My dad left for Mexico because my grandma got sick. I got up the nerve to ask my mom if I could go. I was afraid she'd say no too, even though she was scared of my dad and said that we were both taking a huge risk. She wanted me to go. If he came home, he would beat her and me up for sure. He'd never let me leave the house again. He would probably hold a grudge and blame everything that went wrong on me. But for some reason, even though she was scared, she said I had to go. She said that I deserved it, and I might not ever get this chance again. Wow! I couldn't believe my mom was willing to sacrifice so much for me. It was the first time in my life that I felt hope. I wanted to go so bad. I prayed that it wasn't too late. So the first thing I did the next morning was run to Ms. G's class. Luckily, the baseball team made it to the playoffs, so our star athlete wouldn't be able to go on the trip. Ms. G said I could have his ticket. From that point on, everything was a blur. I had never felt so free. I was so nervous, running from place to place trying to pack. Since I had never been on a vacation, I had no idea how to pack. What should I take? What was I going to wear? I never even had sleepovers when I was a little girl, so this was all new to me. All this was new for my mom, too. She was so scared because I'd never been away from her a day in my life. What if something happened to me? This trip was really for the both of us. I want to share everything with her, every detail, what we ate, what we saw, who we met, everything. This morning when I left, all my relatives were there to say goodbye. Tears rolled down my cheeks as I kissed my mom goodbye. At that moment, I had doubts about my departure, so I asked my mom, "Are you sure you want me to go?" I thought she'd change her mind, but I was wrong. She hugged me and said, "Make good use of this opportunity and don't let me down. I'm so proud of you." Her words gave me so much motivation and inspiration that I can't explain. Now I was ready to say goodbye and leave Long Beach. I headed off on my adventure, an adventure that I'm sure I'll cherish for a lifetime. Her excitement gave me the courage to hop on a plane for the first time. Yeah! I was afraid, but it seemed like nothing else mattered. I can't wait to share everything with her when I get home.
Diary 81. Dear Diary, I'm writing to you from Washington, D.C. We went to Arlington Cemetery today where JFK and many soldiers were buried. As the bus pulled up, I could feel a flood of tears forming in my eyes. I saw the cemetery filled with rows of graves. Like these soldiers, I too have witnessed many die. Many of my friends have been shot in the head and stabbed a number of times, yet their deaths will never be recognized like these men and women. To me, my friends are soldiers, not soldiers of war, but soldiers of the street. With them, it wasn't a fight for territory. It was a fight for their lives. I didn't want to enter the cemetery to see the rest of the graves and memorials for the lost soldiers. I was not being disrespectful, but it made me think back to when I was 12 years old and my father died of AIDS. He never had a headstone to commemorate his life. To this day, he still has nothing but a section of grass that you have to use a map to find. He was just another number, another statistic, someone that no one knew. It makes me sad to see the media only concentrate on the deaths of famous people. I've always asked myself, why do only famous people make the headlines? The media makes a big deal out of a movie star breaking a leg or fracturing a toe. But if a man with as much wisdom as my father passes away, no one cares. Diary 82. Dear Diary, I would say this has been the best night of my life. As we pulled up in our bus at the Lincoln Memorial, I felt as if I was a part of history. It was raining, but we still wanted to see the statue of Abraham Lincoln. It has always been my dream to see the world-famous statue of Abraham Lincoln. At first, I didn't understand why Ms. G wanted us to go to Washington so badly. But now that we're in our nation's capital, it hit me. I will never be the same. I finally realized what being a freedom writer really means. Everyone was standing around the monument, reading the passages on the wall. We all wanted to know what each passage meant, when it was written, and who wrote it. After that, I heard a small voice excitingly yell, "It's time to go back outside in the rain." I knew Ms. G was up to something, because she's always trying to do something spontaneous that has some kind of symbolism in it. This time, it would be the most symbolic of all. We went outside and stood on the stairs of the monument and held hands facing the city, facing the world. To think that Dr. Martin Luther King recited his famous I Have a Dream speech here, where he dreamt that someday little black children and little white children will come together. Ironically, when I look at the Freedom Riders holding hands in the rain, I realize that we are his dream come true. Then all of a sudden, one, two, three, we screamed, Freedom Riders have a dream. The rain stopped, and the sound of our voices echoed across the city.
Diary 83. Dear Diary, as I walk with my group down Pennsylvania Avenue, my eyes filled up with excitement. My lips followed what I saw with a smile, and my heart was full of enjoyment to be in a city that is so different than Long Beach. At that moment, I felt as if I had entered a place where violence and hate did not exist. But in a few seconds, that safe feeling would be all taken away. Damn! Check out this swastika! Can you believe it? Just blocks away from the White House and the Holocaust Museum. Look, there goes another one on that wall, I overheard as we walked down Pennsylvania Avenue. Those feelings I had within me were now found at the tips of my toes. I knew those symbols meant hatred and represented Nazi organizations. My judgment about Washington being perfect was wrong. I guess I kind of judged it for its cover. Anyone can cover up the swastika with paint, but then again, another idiot would probably come back and spray it again. I know from experience. It's sad to say that I once was much like this idiot that sprays on walls, but had different causes. We both destroyed property, but what was being sprayed was way different. The swastika he sprayed is a symbol of hatred. I used to hit up streets with a spray can to get name recognition, not spread hatred. Early the next morning at my breakfast table, my homie and I knew something had to be done. Then we both made up a Freedom Riders logo. So the next time we saw a swastika spray painted on a wall or newspaper stand, we could represent ourselves, the Freedom Riders, without destroying property. I then took the logo we came up with to the hotel concierge and asked if he would be nice enough to make several copies of it. I also asked if he would be willing to give us masking tape to tape our logos and not destroy outside property. Then we left the hotel armed with logos and tape in our hands. We attacked the first swastika we saw on the streets. Everyone joined in and surrounded the symbol. Once we had covered it up with our logo, everyone filled up with joy and started to clap. Once again, my eyes filled with excitement. My lips followed what I saw with a smile. And my heart filled up once again with enjoyment because we had made a difference and I felt safe again. Diary 84. Dear Diary, we took a trip to the Holocaust Museum today. Inside the museum, many memories from my past resurfaced. We sat in a room to watch a movie on how Jewish people were treated during the Holocaust. They were beaten, starved, and forced to watch their loved ones killed before their own eyes by Hitler's troops. As I watched the movie, I began to zone out. Please get off me, I screamed at the boys who were at least 2 feet taller than me and had extremely deep voices. Shut up, you fucking nigger, your kind don't belong here, they screamed as they kicked me harder and harder. I couldn't believe what was happening to me. I was being beaten to the ground for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and not to mention for being the wrong color. Each blow was more powerful and furious than the one before. I tried to open my eyes, but I couldn't. I wanted to see their faces. Who could do this to me? Then in that brief moment, my body went numb. I blacked out. I don't know how much longer they beat me, but when I came to, I was in the middle of the street. I got up to go home, and as I walked, no one tried to help. When I got home, my cousins were asking me what happened. I chose not to say anything. It hurt too much to do anything, so I just went to my room and cried myself to sleep. I slept for about 4 to 5 hours. I would have slept longer, but I was awakened by an unfamiliar smell. Johnny, what the hell are you burning in there? I asked. I don't know where that's coming from. It's not me or anything in here, he said. I got up to see what was going on, what was burning. Was the neighbor's house on fire? I could hear the crackling sound of the wood being burned. As I walked into the living room, it was lit up as if a small lamp was on. Johnny, call the police. I think the neighbor's house is on fire, I said. I moved toward the door and the light from outside began to hurt my eyes, and the closer I got to the door, the warmer it got. I opened the door, and I saw 5 people dressed in white robes. One of them was little and petite. In each of their evil eyes, I saw the reflection of the fire from the cross that was burning on my aunt's lawn. I stood staring at them as if it were an illusion that I was seeing. I closed my eyes thinking that the vision would go away, but when I opened my eyes, the cross was still there. I came to realize that these were the same people who had beaten me earlier that day, and they continued to beat me, not physically, but emotionally. I stepped back, but careful not to take my eyes off of them, and I closed the door and waited for help to arrive. My heart was beating so fast as I sat on the couch, nervous and scared for my life. Hey, come on, a classmate said. When I looked up, the movie was over. My palms were sweaty and I felt as though I had just gone through the same experience again. It seems as though everything tied together, the Jews and a little girl, both victims of a hate crime, and now the graffiti we saw in the nation's capital. I guess some things never change.
Diary 85. Dear Diary, yesterday I was up all night having fun with my roommates. I was planning to go to bed earlier because we were supposed to be ready to leave for the museum at 8 a.m., but my roommates wouldn't shut up. I put a pillow over my head and tried to tune them out. I tried to go to sleep, but I couldn't. I couldn't stop thinking about the Holocaust Museum. I wondered what it's going to be like. I was so curious. But at the same time, I was scared, scared of what I might see. My roommates didn't fall asleep until 4 a.m., so when the alarm went off at 6:30, I thought I was going to die. God, I can't believe what I saw at the Holocaust Museum. I tried to hold back the tears as I walked through the museum, but I couldn't help it. As I walked through the entrance, I thought about Renee Firestone and Gerda Seifer, 2 Holocaust survivors who were visiting the museum with us. I couldn't stop thinking of the pain and suffering they went through. As I walked from room to room, I saw videos about thousands of people being buried in a single grave. How could this have happened? Why didn't someone stand up for these people? How did people just allow them to die? I asked myself these questions as I headed to the next room. I looked at the wall and something caught my attention. It was a quote from a German preacher that summarized the outcome of what happens when no one takes a stand. They came for the trade unions, but I was not a trade unionist, so I didn't respond. Then they came for the socialists, but I was not a socialist, so I didn't respond. Then they came for the Jews, and since I was not a Jew, I didn't respond. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me. Next to this quote, there was a picture of the concentration camp. I looked at that picture for a while, repeating the words in my head. The more I thought about it, the more I cried. Gerda caught up with me and started telling me about the cattle cars that the people were squeezed into. We walked into the next room, and she just stopped. She started crying, and when I asked her what was wrong, she raised her arm, pointing at the cattle car right in front of us. We had to cross through a real cattle car in order to exit the room. She was afraid. She must have imagined her friends and family being shoved into one just like it. I asked her if she was okay. She took a step forward and then started describing how crowded the cars were. She told me that many of the people died before they even got to the concentration camps. When we finally got across it, both of us were crying. Gerda grabbed my hand and thanked me. But I should be the one thanking her. On our way back to the hotel, I saw the swastikas that we had covered. Before, if I saw something bad happen, I probably wouldn't have done anything. I used to think, if it doesn't affect me, why bother? With the covering of the swastikas and everything that happened today, I now know that there is not a day that will go by when, if I believe something is wrong, I won't do anything about it. It is better to take a chance and make a change than it is to pass and pity.
Diary 86. Dear Diary, as we walked through the double doors and entered the cold and scary room at the Holocaust Museum, silence fell upon me as I looked at the death of millions. I never saw so many people dead in one place at the same time. What made it even worse was that it was for no reason at all. I was shocked when I saw those dead people, but I was particularly devastated when I looked at all the twin carcasses. Quicker than a bolt of lightning, it was as if I was going through the same pain and suffering as those innocent twins who were so exploited and mutilated. The more pictures of identical twins I looked at, the more it seemed as if we were there. They say one twin can't last without the other. I couldn't believe that all those twins were forced to test that theory. Dr. Mengele, a doctor at Auschwitz, was obsessed with doing experiments with twins. Rather than using lab mice, twins became his human guinea pigs. He became the angel of death and tortured every twin on the European continent that he could get his hands on. It made me wonder how it would be if I were to lose my twin. Would I have tried my hardest to run away if Mengele singled me out? Would I have tried to fight him? I really don't know because I wasn't there. I wasn't in their shoes. Or would I have even tried to do anything to save any of the other twins? These are some of the questions that ran through my mind as I saw those kids lie there helplessly. The more evil I saw that this man had in him, the more angry I became. All of these horrific pictures of children with their arms and legs cut off of their bodies and put together on another adult or child's body was like looking at a collage of bad dreams that was put together like a picture puzzle. How could one man crush so many dreams? He must have been a man with no heart and no mercy. He got pleasure from someone else's sorrow. Being at the museum made me think about how much I really need and love my twin sister. Even though growing up as a twin has had its good points and bad points, at least I always have someone to talk to, share clothes with, and experiment with. My twin gets on my nerves sometimes, but I would never dream of trading her in for anything in the world. Kids these days have the chance to dream about what they want to be and want to change. It's the changes that affect people's lives for either good or bad. Unfortunately, Dr. Mengele took so many people's chances from them when he took change into his own hands. Taking dreams away is the problem. Making them happen is the solution. Unfortunately, those twins never had a chance to dream the same dream we are making come true. Change. Diary 87. Dear Diary, the big day is here. I can't believe this is my fourth day here in Washington, D.C., and I am actually meeting Secretary of Education Richard Riley. It has been a long day, and there is still more to come. We've just got back from visiting a couple of museums and getting a tour of the Capitol. This has been the longest and most exciting day of my life. What am I going to wear? I have to look nice for tonight's dinner. This is the most important night of all. The people from the Marriott even had a rehearsal for us. I never realized how important this man really is. Now I know that he represents a lot in education. I wonder what he looks like. Is he young or old? Either way, I know I should never judge a book by its cover like Ms. G taught me. He has to be a really important and educated man to be the Secretary of Education, I said to myself. I can't wait to meet him. He will probably be surprised when he sees all of us, a diverse group of teenagers in front of him. I hope he gets excited when he finds out that we came all this way to hand deliver a copy of our book to him. I also hope he can help us pursue our future education. This is going to be a boring night, you know. Long speeches on things I don't even know or understand. This is for grown-ups. What am I doing here? I said to myself at the beginning of the dinner. Richard Riley said, "You are the future leaders. Don't give up." His words really got my attention. I couldn't believe he was the Secretary of Education. I imagined him differently. I thought he would be stuck up like all those other important people, but I was wrong. He's cool. I didn't think he would tell us about his life, but he did. He talked about his life and how he relates to some of us. He told us about all the struggles he had to overcome to become who he is today. I can't believe I'm here, only 5 feet away from the most important man in education. Hopefully, he will take a good look at us and realize that it will only take a few of his words to change our future. He seems like he's moved by what we have accomplished. He made me realize that with education, you can become whoever you want. He made me see things from a very different perspective. I hope one day I can become someone important like Richard Riley, I said to myself while he was walking away. Tonight has been a really good experience. I even got a rose from my date, which was very exciting. Hopefully many nights like this will come, but for tonight, the memories will stay in my heart forever. Diary 88. Dear Diary, this is the poem I wrote that Ms. G asked me to read to Richard Riley at the dinner. I couldn't believe that I was sitting at the head table with all the big shots. I sat next to Ms. G's parents. Her stepmom, Karen, held my hand because I was so nervous. When I finished reading the poem, I got a standing ovation. Stand. Stay black. Stay proud. Stay white, stay proud. Stay brown, stay proud. Stay yellow, stay proud. Don't be afraid to be what you are, 'cause all you can be is you. You'll never be anything else but you. So be the best you you can be. Keep it real, by all means, at all times. Whether a lawyer, a doctor, a football player, a toilet cleaner, a garbage handler, a panhandler. Keep it real and still be the best you can be. Have pride. Have dignity. Stand. Stand proud. Talk proud. Act proud. Be proud. Don't lay down, back down, bow down, run away. Sell out yourself. Sell into criticism. Be real and realize that the ones who criticize best recognize that you are you. Take it or leave it. I knew you'd get it. Get what? The stuff. The stuff called pride, that attitude, that aura, your identity, yourself, your pride, peace of mind, worry-free. See, I can't be you, but I'm a damn good me. Righteous.
Diary 89. Dear Diary, we gave our book to the United States Secretary of Education, Richard Riley, tonight. As I watched him come into the Marriott Ballroom, I couldn't help but notice how different we were. He is a rich, white Southern man from South Carolina with a Southern drawl, and I'm a young black male trying to make it in life, living check by check. But I realized we were both there for the same reasons. We care about the future of kids in America. As I sat there listening to his speech, I realized he actually cared about us. More important, I realized that this man would actually read my diary entry. By reading my diary, he will know all the things that I went through and maybe be in a position to do something about it. As I was listening to him tell us about how he fought against discrimination in the South, I couldn't help but remember the night that my brother got shot, purely based on our race. We were just driving on the freeway when a car full of Mexicans drove up next to us. All of a sudden, I saw sparks flying, glass shattering, and blood splattering. A bullet actually ricocheted all through the car. Another bullet went through the back seat of the car and grazed my friend in the back. My brother, who was driving, was shot 4 times. Twice in his chest, inches from his heart, once in his thigh, and once in his calf. He turned to me with his shirt soaked in blood and said, "I can't breathe no more. I can't drive." He pulled off the road while my 2 friends were yelling in the back seat, "I'm shot! I'm shot!" Trying not to panic, I pulled my brother into my seat. Then I jumped into the driver's seat, which was full of blood, and started looking for a hospital. I finally pulled into a gas station to call the police to tell them my brother got shot. While I was by the phone, I couldn't help but notice that there must have been about 12 bullet holes in the side of the car. The car was totaled. It looked like it had been through a war. In 2 minutes, an ambulance came and they took my brother and my friend to the hospital. Then the police took me to the hospital. The hospital was only a block away. When I got there, the doctor took me into the room to see my brother. He had tubes all in him. I didn't know what to think. Then my brother made this joke from a movie. He said, "The doctor told me I'm never going to walk again." I knew that was a line from a movie, but I didn't know whether to laugh or to cry. Then my brother went into surgery for 6 hours so they could remove the bullets. Apparently his lungs collapsed. I thought he was going to die. If he died, it would have been for the simple fact that we were black and in the wrong place at the wrong time. Luckily, he came out of surgery okay and was only in the hospital for 1 week. His doctor told me that if I didn't react like I did by getting my brother to the hospital so soon, he would have died. The doctor said, "That makes you a hero." I guess it does. It made me realize that a real hero should try to prevent this from ever happening again. I guess that's why I want Richard Riley to read my story. I want him to know that the guys with guns were absolute strangers. All they saw was our color because they were ignorant. If they were educated, like I am, they'd learn to see past shades and beyond exteriors and see people. I guess that's why the Freedom Riders had to write about our lives and share them with him, because he's in a position to educate kids like that. Unfortunately, Secretary Riley can't change what happened to my brother and me, but maybe he can help us spread our message so it doesn't happen to another innocent teen. Diary 90. Dear Diary, last night we had a candlelight vigil for our family and friends we've lost to senseless violence. Right after we dedicated our bound copy of the book to the Secretary of Education, Richard Riley, we all held hands to form an unbreakable chain and marched out of the hotel toward the Washington Monument. The chain we made was so long that we held up traffic while crossing the busy intersection on Pennsylvania Avenue. When we were crossing the street, some guy asked what we were doing. Someone said, "Changing the world." But the weird thing about that is, the fact that this candlelight vigil was one of the stepping stones used by us to get in a position where we can truly make a change for the better and influence others to change too. So we really were changing the world. When we reached the Washington Monument, we formed a huge circle around it, and we all began to sing "Stand By Me." During that moment, tears of mourning began to fall from everyone except me. I didn't want to think about painful memories of close friends whose lives were blown away like dust in the wind. We held hands again and walked back to the hotel after we pinned the buttons that had names of people who were killed because of violence on a tree in front of the Washington Monument. The pain that everyone was feeling didn't hit me until we arrived back at the hotel. I just couldn't hold it anymore. I began to think about all the times that I was almost killed and the fact that my name could have been on one of those buttons. Right at that moment, I felt like I was going to have a nervous breakdown. My heart was beating fast as the tears ran down my face because all of those painful memories that came back. I had constant flashbacks of all the guns put to my head, all of the bullets that barely missed me, and all the times I thought to myself, "Just give up. They're going to kill you anyway." But I couldn't give up. I didn't give up. And I will never give up. Diary 91. Dear Diary, I'm thousands of feet in the air in a Freedom Rider-only plane on my way home from Washington, D.C. As I look at the clouds, ice crystals build up on my window, and my eyes become heavy with fatigue. It was hard checking in our baggage and then running to the plane. The girls' bags were 10 times heavier than when we left. I'm sitting here thinking, okay, so this is what it's like to fly first class. This is my second time on a plane. The first was when we went to Washington. Me on a plane? If I'd never met Miss G, this would never have happened. Yeah, right, my sister said when I told her I was flying to D.C. Even my stepdad was skeptical. I saved my plane tickets just so I would have proof that I'd actually gone, to show him when I get home. Actually, I saved just about everything. My movie ticket, a handkerchief from the hotel, even the soap and shower cap. You're probably wondering how one little female high school teacher brought such drastic changes into my life. Well, I have about 4 hours before we land in LAX, so I'm going to sit here and tell you a story of how my life was changed by this little high school teacher. Just 13 years ago, I felt helpless, like I'd never be free. 13 years ago may seem like a long time ago, but to me, it seemed like yesterday. Give me some money, a deep, booming voice yelled at my mom. I don't have any, my mom cried. Yes, you do. I know you do. You just got your welfare check. You better give me some money or I'm going to fuck your son up. Afraid this man would hurt her child, my mom foolishly gave him all the money she had in her purse. It couldn't have been more than $20. Yeah, I thought you didn't have any money, you lying bitch. When I get back, that little nigger better be gone, he said. I sat trembling on the couch, his prized possession. And get the hell off my couch. He grabbed me by my shirt and threw me across the room. Then he picked me up by the neck. All I could think of was, why is he doing this to me? I didn't do anything to defend myself. It's kind of scary having a 6'4" giant with arms built to play football grab you by the neck and throw you into the trunk of a car. While in the trunk, I could hear my mom screaming. I could hear the sound of his fist smashing against her face. I stayed in that grease-infested trunk for at least a day. It was morning when my mom finally let me out. The daylight burned my eyes. My pants were soaking wet with a combination of dirt, car oil, and urine. We didn't have any soap or hot water, so my mom bathed me with dishwashing liquid in a tub of ice-cold water. All of my mother's welfare money supported her maniac boyfriend's cocaine habit. There was never any money left for food, just enough for top ramen noodles. It was our breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Most of the time we had to eat that raw. My mom was 8.5 months pregnant. With all the stress in her life, she had to be rushed to the hospital in premature labor. And I was stuck in the house with a child abuser, woman beater, murderer, drug user, and ex-convict. I was constantly being hit, constantly being told I would never be anything. I ain't shit. I'll never be shit. I knew there would be trouble as soon as my mom left for the emergency room. The second this thought entered my mind, this madman started yelling at me. It's your fault that she's gone. Don't start that crying shit. I'd have beat your ass. I was home by myself most of the time my mom was in the hospital. My mom's boyfriend exchanged all her jewelry with his dealer so he could buy his drugs. When my mom came home, the rent and all the bills were overdue, so we were evicted. We were given a week to move, but we didn't have anywhere to go. We couldn't move in with my grandmother because her boyfriend caused too much trouble. Our only option was his mother's house. We left everything behind, which wasn't much, and moved into a dingy garage. For 2 years we lived in a garage with the gardening tools, old furniture, a tiny black and white TV, and a lone mattress in the center. There was no heat, no air conditioning, no fan, and no restroom. It was just Mom, her new daughter, her boyfriend, and me. When we finally got our own house, her boyfriend took the bedroom, and my mom, my sister, and I slept in the living room. So in essence, we'd come full circle. The only difference this time is that I'm older, I understand more, and I have more fear in my heart due to previous beatings. At least once a week, there was an argument between the two either over money or me living in the house. Sometimes they just argued over why there's money in the house and no cocaine. For years he sold drugs out of the house where my mom paid rent, where my mom paid the bills and bought food. After living in such chaos for so long, I began to believe my mom's boyfriend. Maybe I wouldn't amount to anything, but Miss Gruel helped me prove him wrong by making me realize the things he said were not true, and that nothing that happened between him and my mother was my fault. Diary 92. Dear Diary, I have finally taken a real vacation. I have always had to go to summer school, and I've never had time off. Well, thanks to the Freedom Riders, I got to go to the nation's capital. I had the best time I ever had in my life. My only regret is that I didn't have a camera during the whole trip to capture this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Everything in Washington, D.C. was great. It was my first time in a really nice hotel. I got to stay up late and didn't have to worry about my parents telling me to go to sleep. The first two nights, I never slept because I kept thinking my parents were going to call. They never did. On my way home from Washington, D.C., I finally fell asleep on the plane. I dreamed about the events that happened and how things were going to be when I got home. When we got off the bus, it wasn't what I expected. My parents were there. At first, I just thought that maybe they were out getting gasoline for the car or eating out, but not to see me. Boy, was I surprised when they came up to me, gave me a hug, and asked me about my trip. I felt so welcome. This is something I'm not used to. Before I left, my parents always used to make me feel bad. They always thought I was bad, and I was constantly in trouble. I always argued with them, and sometimes I even hated them. But tonight, I forgot about all the bad times, and I felt close to them. When we got home, I walked in the house wondering why there was a lot more cars parked out on the street. Everybody was at my house, from my closest relatives to people that I've only talked to once or twice. This was the first time since my sister got married that everybody was here. Were they here to see me? When I walked in, everybody started congratulating me. I felt really happy, as though nothing in the world would ever put me down. I wish I had taken pictures for them to see, but they were so excited just listening to me, and all their eyes were looking at me. I sat in the middle of the living room telling them about my trip. I told them about how amazing the Capitol building was. I mean, I have never seen such beautiful paintings and magnificent sculptures. I described how the Lincoln Memorial was the biggest statue that I'd ever seen. I also told them about the cruise we took up the Potomac River. There was so much food that I ate until I could no longer get up. While I was outside on the deck, waving hello to everyone, it started to rain. But that didn't stop anybody from having fun. Everybody went inside the boat and started dancing and singing. I also told them how I was hoping that we would get a tour of the White House. But at least I got to see the White House in person, even though it was from behind the front gate. As I was describing Washington, they had the look of envy in their eyes. Tonight, for the first time in my life, I was the main attraction in my house. Everybody was congratulating me and congratulating my parents for having such a good, smart, and fascinating son. They said I am a role model for the family and hopefully for the world. Diary 93. Dear Diary, as I entered the school this morning, still tired from our trip, I noticed that everyone was acting weird, like something crazy happened. There were media vans in front of the school, and the first thing I thought to myself was they were there to welcome the Freedom Riders back and to write an article about us. But they weren't. So I asked one of my friends, "What the hell happened?" He replied, "You know Jeremy Strohmeyer?" I said, "Yeah, Jeremy Strombacher, which is the name we used to call him when we joked around with him." Then my friend said, "Well, Jeremy was arrested." Apparently, Jeremy had brutally raped and murdered a 7-year-old girl in a Nevada casino. He had taken a Memorial Day weekend trip with a friend, another student at our school, and the friend's father to Las Vegas. On the way, the father stopped at a casino in Prim, Nevada. While the father gambled, Jeremy and his friend hung out in the arcade. Jeremy began playing tag with the little girl, followed her into the women's restroom, where he raped and murdered her in a bathroom stall. The friend with Jeremy was also in the restroom at the time, but he left and did nothing to stop this crime. At first, I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. I considered Jeremy an acquaintance because we had been on the same soccer team, and we'd see each other around school. How could he possibly do such a thing? The more I heard, the more confused I felt. Jeremy had a dark side to his personality. He had child pornography on his computer, and he was abusing drugs. This is a lethal combination. Although not an excuse, such things can make a person with such a dark and disturbed side commit acts they may never have if not under their influence. I saw the media bombarding our campus with questions. We realized pretty quickly that they were not after our story. The Freedom Riders might as well have been on Mars for all the attention we got. It's ironic that while the Freedom Riders were taking a symbolic stand against violence in our candlelight vigil at the Washington Monument, a murder was being carried out. No wonder young people are so easily stereotyped. The media seems to focus more on the negative rather than on the positive things that young people accomplish. It makes me sad that this horrible murder moved the Freedom Riders story to the back cover, while Jeremy's got the front page. Diary 94. Dear Diary, today I heard the news, along with the news. I heard the rumors. Jeremy and David killed a girl in Las Vegas. No, wait. It was just Jeremy, while David stood by and watched. Or was it that Jeremy murdered her without his best friend knowing about it? Once school ended, I decided to sort this whole thing out. I watched the news and finally learned the supposed truth. David watched Jeremy drag the girl into the bathroom stall, and he left before Jeremy killed her. What a case of tragic irony. 150 students traveled to Washington, D.C. to actively acknowledge the violence in Long Beach. Two travel to Las Vegas, where one eventually murders a young girl, and the other leaves while she is struggling. How could David walk away without helping her? This is a question that I can't answer. Although I've never been in that type of situation, I do know that what he did isn't right. It should never be solved with the just-look-the-other-way normal approach to solving trials. In any and every situation, non-action is never a sane and rational approach. To illustrate this point, picture living in a small town filled with normal people just like you. Every day, loaded trains come in, make their deliveries, and leave. Factories constantly bellow smoke. Then one day, you notice the trains aren't making the simple deliveries anymore, and the factories aren't bellowing mere smoke. Would you rock the boat and speak out, or would you remain silent as the people of Auschwitz did? The saying is true. If you're not for it, then you're against it. David Cash wasn't for saving the life of that young girl, in the same way many Poles weren't for saving the Jews. They watched the trains and smelled the ashes, ignoring tragedy. David had a chance to be a hero, to both Jeremy and that little girl.
Diary 95. Dear Diary, I was late to school this morning because we had just come home from Washington, D.C., very late at night, and I wanted to tell my mom everything we had done. When I got to school, I had to go through the front door instead of my usual route. Guess what I saw? Swarms of news cameras. I was so excited. I thought they were all here because the Freedom Riders had just come back